You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 8th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
And Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein is out this week. He is neck deep in other people's taxes.
Ew.
You gotta do it. Well, you know what? He had like a weird like mid-tax break, which he's never had before. Think about it.
Right. Yeah, I think everybody did. I just filed mine last night.
I was so like, screw this. You know, I'm not finishing this crap. I hate it.
Well, and also, I think the thing is, nobody really knew what was going to happen, but a lot of people got hit super hard, which is why the tax deadline was pushed back. So they're like, I can't afford to pay my taxes right now, but maybe come July, I'll be in a better place financially. Unfortunately, a lot of people are kind of in a worse place financially now.
Yeah.
They're just kind of kicking the can down the road.
Yeah. Speaking of that, Steve, what are the latest?
Yeah,
COVID
the numbers are not good, you know, especially in the United States. So worldwide, we've surpassed 12 million cases with over 550,000 deaths. In the U.S., we're over 3 million cases and around 130,000 deaths, at least. That number is always at least because there's probably more. And, you know, it's just in the U.S., you know, it's just exactly what we warned about. We're seeing this second hump in the first wave. And the greatest number of new cases per day is happening right now. This is a greater surge than we had back in March and April. And this is what we talked about. You know, what happens when we start to open up? And what happens if then cases start to surge again? What will we do? You know, people have lockdown fatigue. You know, the economy's already taken a big hit from the first lockdown. Some states opened up too quickly. They didn't do it properly with enough testing and contact tracing. And now we're seeing this really bad second wave.
And the sad thing is they're having to do it kind of haphazardly. Like they're the states where they said, okay, we want to reopen. So either they never really fully locked down or they did, but they only stayed locked down for like 2 weeks. And then they were like, okay, bars, we got to reopen. We got to get the economy going. And now the cases are just bananas out of control. And so they're doing this like, oh, quick, put your mask back on, you know? And it's kind of like, it's haphazard. It's not clean. It doesn't feel as controlled. And I think that's where things really do fall through the cracks. And then, of course, we have this whole political anti-mask movement that does seem to correlate with some of the same states where we're seeing these spikes. We definitely see in California, I mean, in, you know, in more conservative districts, but they're sort of marbled in California. So I definitely hear it even in LA. It's not as common, but Orange County's not that far away. San Bernardino County's very close, and you see the people, you know, holding up angry signs, and it's just...
Did you guys hear that they did a study and showed that if they mandated mask use, if you know, they made it pretty much a requirement, everyone wearing masks in public, that they could save 45,000 lives over the course of, I'm not sure what the course of the period of time would be. I think like 3 or 4 months.
Oh my God.
45,000. I mean, if that number, yeah. if that was fairly solid number, what else would you need? It's like, okay, then we're doing this. You have to wear a mask in public, period.
Yeah, that's almost the Vietnam War right there, right? The Vietnam War was 50,000. So imagine we could save the same number of lives we lost over 10 years of the Vietnam War just by wearing masks.
I think it's such a profound number that we're not even equipped intellectually to really understand that much less.
Right. Like I don't know 45,000 people. I can't picture 45,000 people sitting in a room. I don't know what that looks like.
Yeah.
Well, look at like a baseball or football stadium.
How many are in that?
Wouldn't that be roughly in the ballpark, so to speak?
It's larger than the student body of my alma mater.
And speaking of masks, you know, I saw a study this week that people might be interested in. So they just compared different types of masks and how well they work. And of course, the ones that you think should work the best do, right? So the N99 masks that are supposed to stop 99% of the virus were the best, followed by N95 masks.
Of course, yeah.
Block 95% of the virus. And their tests show that those numbers are roughly accurate. And then followed by surgical masks. So they were the next. So those are the ones that, you know, that healthcare workers are using, and they do work the best. For the homemade ones, what they said was the best. So actually, interestingly, using vacuum cleaner filters was the best, like, homemade option. You just make a little pocket in your mask, you put those filters in there, and you can replace them, like, if they get moist or used. And that was the best. Using any kind of a close weave, you know, tight knit cotton was good. They said what did not work is wearing a scarf. Doesn't really do much. It's only a slightly better than no mask at all, or a t-shirt, like pulling a t-shirt up over your face. Doesn't work very much at all either. So stick with the, you know, the thicker multi-layer cotton. And if you could put a filter in there, that's the best.
That's what most of mine are. They're like a mask with a pocket. So that's two layers. And then you put those 2.5 micron that you can just buy them in bulk on Amazon, these little filters. And they're already cut. Like, they're the right size for a mask. And then I find that nose wire helps. I even bought some nose wires that you can, like, you blast them with a hairdryer. Mm-hmm. And then it, like, softens the glue and you stick them on. And now all of a sudden they're not leaking and they're not fogging up my glasses. And
here's a question. So you got a mask on. Now, you say you're a healthcare worker. You go and you could work 8 hours a day. That's at one end of the spectrum. 8 to 10 hours a day. Other end of the spectrum, you have a mask. You go to the store for 20 minutes and you're mm-hmm. done. How often do you have to wash that and change that filter depending on where you are on that spectrum?
From what I understand, Steve, let me know if you've read something different. You should wash it or change it if it ever gets moist from your breath.
Yeah, that's basically it. If it gets moist or too wet, then you should clean it.
Yeah, okay. Moistness. And it's the same for healthcare workers. If they're low on PPE, I mean, ideally you would change it between patients or you do whatever, but if they're low on PPE, a lot of times that's what they say is wear it until it starts to get moist, then you have to throw it away and put a new one on.
Wow.
So Steve, I came across some interesting COVID coverage about a study that was published on, you know, a preprint server, so it's not peer reviewed. But these researchers are looking for what they consider to be a more comprehensive metric. You know, we've talked a lot on the show about a case fatality rate. Like, we've heard that used a lot. And I think we even went over it in detail previously. But just as a quick refresher, that's the number of deaths divided by the number of confirmed cases. But of course, we've also talked about how that's a difficult metric because in a lot of places, people aren't getting tested or the cases never get confirmed.
Right.
And also, one of the biggest reasons that this metric is really kind of not telling us much is that there's so many asymptomatic carriers. And so they're never getting being counted in the first place. So these researchers are proposing using a more comprehensive metric. They didn't make it up. This metric is used a lot. It's called the infection fatality rate. And so instead of just the number of confirmed cases, what they're doing is they're either looking at known infections, and that's based on things like antibody tests, or there is a statistical, some statistical juju that they use to calculate the likely number of infections. So you've got your serology studies that could tell you, again, that you know, what percentage of people have the antibodies for it, so they have been infected, or they can look at small pockets of places and kind of extrapolate that out to say, okay, this is the likely number of asymptomatic carriers within this part of the population. And when they look at the infection fatality rate and they compared it to something like the seasonal flu, they realize that COVID is pretty deadly. So for COVID-19, they are estimating something that's twice as high as earlier estimates, which is that between 500 and 1,000 people are dying for every 100,000 infections.
Wow.
You compare that to the flu is between 1 and 10 people dying for every 100,000 infections. So that's, 50 to 100 times more deadly than the seasonal flu.
Wow.
They talk quite a bit about why these numbers are so hard to pin down. And obviously there's a big range there depending on, you know, if you're in the group of older adults, if you're in the group of people who have these pre-existing conditions. But they say a lot of the problem is just delay. And it's not just bureaucratic delay, it's also like actual medical delay. So not only Are we getting delays in getting our test results back or testing somebody who does die and, you know, knowing that it was a positive case? But also, there's a delay just in getting developing symptoms. So it's like, first you get infected, and then there's a delay before you might even start to show symptoms. And then even if you are showing symptoms, there's a delay before the symptoms become severe. And then if the symptoms become severe, there's a delay before you die if you're one of the unlucky ones, unfortunately, who passes away. And then there's the backlog of the testing and then the recording of the tests. So we're talking sometimes months before we know the data of what's happening with individuals from, you know, 2 months ago or a month ago.
Wow, that long.
Mm-hmm. They kind of go through, they say a CDC analysis found if someone's infected with the coronavirus today, they won't start to show symptoms for 4 to 5 days on average, but it could take up to 2 weeks. CDC analysis showed that severe difficulty breathing was 5 to 8 days after the start of symptoms, admission to ICU 10 to 12 days after the start of symptoms. Average people who died were hospitalized for 12.7 days before they died. And then they said prior to that, yeah, here's the paperwork part. It can take several days for officials to receive notification of a death, and then they log the deaths. And the CDC added an extra step just to make sure that it was safe and that they were confirming. So this is not done computationally. Human people are inputting and verifying the death certificate before they count that as a case. So it just adds to the delays.
Yeah, this disease is no joke. You know, the more we learn about COVID, this is the thing, we're finding the deadlier that it is. We're finding that it's more of a vascular infection, you know, than just a respiratory infection. It causes blood clots. You know, we're seeing more neurological complications. This is, you know, this is a very bad disease. But okay, let's get on with the news items. Jay, we're going to start with you. And I sent you this news item because I like to talk about cognitive biases. And this is a new interesting little cognitive bias. Tell us about it.
Kara, let me ask you a question.
Yes, please.
So in your gut, What number sounds better to you? And don't overthink it. Just give me your gut response. If I were to say that a new medication could actually prevent you from getting the common cold and it was 91.34% effective, or if I were to say if it was 90% effective, which one feels better in your mind?
91.34.
Right. Now, that is probably because you are a trained skeptic and critical thinker.
Because the number is higher.
Yeah. I mean, obviously. And I think most people would say, well, of course I would, you know, I would go for the higher number. You know, I would. Mm-hmm. But the problem with the 91.34% when you compare it to the 90 is that your brain treats it differently. And let me give you the backstory real quick. Gaurav Jain, an assistant professor of marketing at the Lally School of Management at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, published a paper called Revisiting Attribute Framing, the Impact of Number Roundness on Framing. Wow. That may have been one of the longest sentences I've ever said in my life. But let me.
Jay, what was the name of the school?
This is the Institute of Bob Novella wishes that he had nanites in his brain right now.
No, Jay, you said it's a Lally school? Lolly,
get your adverbs here. Yes. So let me shorten this up for you. This is about something called behavioral economics and attribute framing. So this practice determines how people will make different decisions depending on the way information is presented to them, right? I think you get that. So historically, when researchers studied behavioral economics, they're paying close attention to the adjectives that describe what is actually being measured. Hey, Bob, there's the word adjectives. That's very funny. So they're paying close attention to the words that are descriptor words, right? The adjectives.
Like fat-free instead of low-fat.
Right, exactly.
You know, things like that, yeah.
But this new idea is to look at the numbers that were presented and do the numbers and the different slight differences in the numbers have any real measurable effect on what people perceive. So in this particular study, they had 1,500 participants and they took 6 different sets of data. The question they wanted to answer was, how will people's perception change if they used non-round numbers, right? So what's a non-round number? An example is 21.34 instead of saying the number 20.
Interesting, but what about like 99.99? Because historically, that was supposed to make you think it was not 100.
Yeah, Kara, that's called the leftmost digit bias. We estimate numbers at the shorthand is by looking at the leftmost digit. So 1995, we look at the 1. So we think that's a lot less than 20 because the leftmost digit's 2. And we don't look at all the numbers to necessarily process that it's only slightly less.
Yeah, it's psychological pricing.
That's what that is without a doubt. Yeah, you're totally right. But this is more about communicating important information where the actual number turns out to be a non-round number,
right?
Versus giving the public a round number. So what the research team found was that non-round numbers cause people to think about the uniqueness of the number instead of absorbing the concept the number represents. So they found that people would contemplate the non-round number to whatever the best case scenario number would be. So as an example, if 100% is the best case scenario, and you gave a non-round number of 93.7%, they would have to think longer on how that number relates to 100%.
Yeah.
Than if they just said 90%. So it leaves like...
Yeah, it's more meaningful. It's like when you say things like, nearly a quarter of respondents answered this way. It just means more than when you say 23.67% of respondents.
Yep. Yeah, it's kind of like a shorthand to giving the information. And this is what I thought was fascinating. The researchers said that numbers have their own kind of language that can give someone a non-numerical perception, right? Mm-hmm. I think that is so cool. Like there is definitely a way that numbers feel. There's an emotional component to the number and how it comes off to you emotionally. So the takeaway is that when communicating important information, like we were saying, like public health, they should try not to use non-round numbers because the end results may be that people's subjective assessment of the number may feel less than a very close but lower round number, right? So like the 91 point something versus saying 90%. Just say the 90% because people might think the 91% feels lower to them emotionally.
Right. Yeah. This really relates to the thing I did last week on the show about data visualization and sort of numeracy, and when you're making an infographic, you know, what's going to pack the most punch? How are you going to get the point across as fast as possible? I could definitely see, you know, 25% like hits you in the face, whereas like a random number with a bunch of decimal points, you're right, you have to think about it more.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's neat. I think the bottom line is, this is like a good deeper concept here, is that our brains are biased towards efficiency, right? We're going to take that shortcut.
Right. It's a shortcut.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why we look at just the leftmost digit. We look at, we can relate to round numbers or easy fractions. And anything that makes our brain work less hard, we prefer, and we can wrap our head around a lot easier. All right, Kara, you're going to talk about something that is actually a little bit counterintuitive, perhaps, but you can run the numbers and you can convince yourself that this is a good idea. Tell us about pooled testing.
Right. So the idea here is that given the state of the pandemic right now and sort of the amount of potential background infection rate, it is highly likely that it would be more efficient, both in terms of cost and kind of in terms of time and pressure on the laboratories to do pooled testing instead of individuals testing. So let's talk about what pooled testing is. Let's say you work in on a production.
In a pool?
Yeah, let's say you work in a pool. Let's make this complicated. But let's say, so a lot of TV shows are starting to come back into production. Not mine. It was canceled. But mine was actually a multi-million dollar show with like hundreds of crew, which was just going to be impossible to do in this climate.
Aww.
Yeah, unfortunately. But let's say it's a smaller show and you've got a crew of 20 people and you want to make sure that there are no active infections on your crew. So you need to be doing tests, let's say, twice a week. You could give every single person on the crew a test, send those tests to the lab, test them each individually, and then get all of the individual responses. Or you could do something called pooled testing, where you take 5 people, take their samples and put them in the same tube, take the next 5, put their samples in the same tube. So now you're only sending 4 tests to the lab. If everybody's negative, everybody's negative regardless. But if, let's say, 1 or 2 people are positive, you'll get a positive result on that pool, and then you can go back in and individually test the people from the pool. So let's run the numbers here. 20 individual tests the first time, one person comes back positive, you know who it is because you ran their tests individually. Four different tests, because we're pooling groups of five, one person comes back positive. That means that only one pool came back positive, so now you have to retest those five. So now you're running nine tests as opposed to 20, and you're getting the same result. And this can actually save not just a lot of money, because these individual tests can be very expensive, but also physical lab time and space. And this has been one of the biggest problems, at least in the US, but I think in a lot of other countries, where the labs are just overwhelmed with these COVID tests. So there are long delays, and you know, it's getting complicated. Now, there's a threshold, obviously, algorithm here. If you're starting to get a lot of positive results back, it no longer becomes efficient. And it's actually more efficient to do individual testing.
Yeah.
And you can do the math on that. But, you know, everybody can imagine where that would be, right? Once you start to get a lot of positives.
Well, Kara, what does it do for sensitivity?
Well, here's the other interesting thing. So there have been a lot of questions about that, right? So, Bob, one of the main questions that people have asked is, does diluting the number of samples actually basically dilute the DNA and make it so that you can't detect the virus in the sample as much? And it turns out that the studies that have been done on this show that the outcomes are equivalent. So it's just as sensitive to do an individual test than to do a pooled test, but you can only pool up to a certain number. I think the cap they're looking at is around 8. You don't want to put like more than 8 samples.
So if you're an individual test and you're at the edge of sensitivity, you were just starting to be detected. And then, but instead of doing a single test, you pool it with four or five others, you would still be detected.
I mean, I'm not sure if on the boundaries of the normal curve that's the case, but definitely in the studies that have been done about, am I getting a positive result? It's probably just an all or nothing response. Is it positive in the pool versus is it positive in the individual? They're showing that the efficacy seems to be the same. But there are some other considerations. Actually, one that's kind of in the favor of pooling is that the sensitivity of the test is still not amazing. Like, we're getting still a lot of false negatives on tests. I think I saw in one of these articles it was upwards of 20%. And so the idea of retesting is actually really beneficial, and you're more likely to get two tests out of a pooled situation if there is a positive, right? So if you just think of sheer numbers, it's kind of like, I don't know, any woman who's listening, or I should say anyone who has a cervix who's listening, who's had to have a pap or who's had to have a colposcopy or something like that, you know, you sometimes you'll go in, let's say it's abnormal, you need to get retested before you do something more serious. Or anybody who's had an abnormal biopsy for cancer or something, you got to get retested just to make sure that it wasn't an aberrant test. And it's kind of the same with COVID, not across the board, but obviously your results are going to be more robust, reliable if you get tested more than once. And so for people who work in industries like healthcare professionals who are exposed a lot, they're getting tested all the time. But you might have just felt crummy once, decided you wanted to get tested, it came back negative, and you were like, whew, okay, there's still a chance. I don't want to put fear in you. It's a low chance, but there's still a chance. So getting retested can sometimes be helpful. And if you are getting a pooled test, you're more likely to be tested twice, especially if you end up in a pool that comes back positive. But the problem becomes when two things. When the background rate gets too high, all of a sudden, this is no longer efficient. And also, if the labs, because the way that prices are set in the US are very different in other parts of the world, where the burden is on those kinds of decisions often fall within the labs themselves or the insurance companies themselves. They're not often regulated or mandated. So if all of a sudden the lab says, well, I'm just going to charge five times as much for a pool test with five samples in it, then it's no longer going to be more efficient either.
Even still, Kara, because, you know, when we're talking about efficiency here, we're not just talking about cost. You could look at this a few ways. Like, if you take a public health perspective, you could say, all right, I have this fixed amount of reagent. How many people in this community can I detect with COVID-19 using this amount of reagent. And you could run the numbers and you could show that using pool testing, depending on, again, the background rate, you might be able to screen many more people because there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be screened in those pools that and when the entire pool is negative. So it'll just make it's a good way to make your reagent go further. And also, you can even count a little bit of an increased false negative rate from pooling because you're diluting out the test a little bit. But even if the false negative rate goes up a little bit, you'll still detect more people with the pooled testing because you're going to be able to screen so many more with the same resources that you have.
Yeah, so right now, the background rate seems to be ideal for this. But you're right, that could change. Mm-hmm. And it depends on where in the world you're looking. Also, so they're saying, for example, they used LA versus Montana, which is weird because one's a city and one's a whole state, but okay. So they're saying as of June 27th, so this was, you know, the end of last month, about 9% of people tested in LA were positive. So that might reduce test use by about 50%. So they must have run the algorithm. And then in Montana, where only 0.1% of the population has come back positive, it could reduce test use by 90%. The other thing that's important that we didn't even really talk about, because we were talking about it more pragmatically from like, I need to test the office, I need to test the production, is that from a public health perspective, by and large, like an epidemiological perspective, this is a way to very much more quickly and easily and cheaply figure out what's going on in the public, sampling in the population to figure out what is that actual background rate. Because all of our samples right now are relatively biased. As long as there's a barrier to getting tested if you're asymptomatic, we're going to have biased background rates.
All right, we're going to shift gears here a little bit and talk about eating insects.
Oh, God. This is really coming up in the news so much now. Like, I feel like it's inevitable.
It can be good.
Well, first of all, Jay, it's already happening. You know, insects are consumed by lots of people around the world and increasingly in industrialized nations. But I agree with you. It's inevitable that we're going to be increasing our consumption of insects. And, you know, I think first, it'll be in ways that you won't even detect, like in cricket flour. You know, like stuff will be baked with flour made from, you know, ground up insects, and you won't notice it. But also, you know, we're getting better at making like meal larvae, stuff like that, into, you know, ground up protein based foods that you're not going to be eating, like stuff with legs on it, for example. But what I'm talking about in this news item, though, is not humans eating insects, but animals eating insects, feeding insects to animals as part of the agricultural ecosystem, you know. So to back up a little bit, you know, what I want to talk about is encouraging people to think about these complex topics like agriculture in terms of a coherent system and to get away from simplistic things like, you know, vegetables good, meat bad, because it's not, it's all in how things get incorporated into the overall system. And sure, you know, in industrialized nations, we're consuming too much meat protein and there's an increasing demand on meat protein. But that doesn't mean that all meat production is bad or that it would be a good thing for the planet or the system to completely eliminate meat. We have to think about this in a more nuanced, more systems way. And insect feed to animals could become part of this system. That is what the discussion is about and what a news item is about that I'm going to get to a little bit later. So first, let me talk about the amount of calories that we can produce per acre of land, because land use efficiency is probably one of the biggest issues when it comes to producing food. Water use efficiency is another big one, but I think land use is probably the biggest. Let's talk about the million calories per acre, which is one metric that is used. So the greatest calories per acre, million calories per acre, that on the table that I'm looking at is potatoes, right? Potatoes are a massively efficient way of producing a staple food, and they have a lot of different, you know, vitamins and minerals in there. Potatoes basically have everything you need except for the protein. Corn is also pretty high, 12.3 million calories per acre. Wheat is 6.4, you know, only about half as much as corn, a little bit more than a third of potatoes. And then we get down into the meat range. You have pork is actually not bad, 3.5, chicken 1.4, beef 1.1. But here's a surprise. So soybeans, which is, you know, soy, tofu, yeah, is probably the most common plant protein that replaces meat protein. Soybeans is only 2.1. That's less than pork. So, you know, in terms of land use efficiency, soybean is less efficient than raising pigs. And it's, you know, it's pretty much down there in the meat range. So it's not really fair to compare. And a lot of people do this. Oh, if we got rid of cows and we just ate the plants directly, we ate the corn directly, you know, it's so many times more efficient, you know, 10 times more efficient. It's like, yeah, but you can't really compare beef to corn. You know, you have to compare beef to another protein source like soybeans. And there it's not that different. But it also depends on the system that is used to feed the beef, because it's also not a fair comparison, because all of the land and resources that we're using to grow calories from animals won't be converted or cannot be converted into human food, right? So you have to say how much of the calories that it takes to make a cow are calories that could be consumed by humans. It might be less than you think. That percentage is actually not that high. It depends on the system, but a typical figure might be something like only 20% would be fed calories that were potentially edible by humans, which means 80%. You know, animals are converting 80% of the food that they eat from non-edible to edible by humans. So a lot of that, for example, is grazing. And so again, a lot of people don't know this, but cows are most of the growing that cows do. You know, raising a cow from a calf to an adult is done through grazing. And then when cows are almost ready to go to slaughter, then they go to a feedlot for finishing, right? And so the high-grade food, whether that's corn or whatever, is in the finishing lot, and that's like the last 10% or so, you know, of the calories that they pack on. But most of their growing and most of their bulk, most of their calories comes from grazing. And grazing is on, obviously, grass, which can't be consumed by humans, and also on land that's probably not suitable for farming. So you can't just convert grazing land to farmland. And so it's a way for humans to convert more land and food waste and inedible food into food, basically by processing it through animals. Animals can also eat a lot of the stuff that comes from agriculture that's not the edible parts. Like you grow corn, we eat the corn kernels, but there's the cob and the husk and the stalk, and that could be made into fertilizer, that could be ground back into, you know, to the field, or it could be fed to animals, or it can be turned into biofuel, be another sort of pathway there. But all the parts of the food could be used. And you also have to consider all the outputs of the animals, which is not just calories, right? Because cows produce more than meat. They produce leather. They produce a lot of material that feeds hundreds of industries, lubricant, you know, and other things that they produce. And so medicines, you know, come from animal parts. So you have to consider all of the outputs and all the inputs. And when you think about it, and that also includes manure, by the way, which is like fertilizing half of the food that we eat. When you think about it, you have to think of this whole system. You know, the meat, you know, in animals is an efficient part of the agricultural system because it is, you know, again, it's using a lot of calorie products that are not suitable for human consumption, and we get a lot out of them more than just meat. But of course, there still needs to be an optimal amount. Again, you have to think about the whole system. That doesn't mean more is better. It just means that there's a certain amount that optimally maximizes the efficiency of any farm, of any growing system. Okay. Now, what the news item is about adding insects to the finishing feed of animals. So rather than feeding them corn or something else, you can get high-grade protein out of larvae, for example, out of mealworms or something like that, and that could maybe add some extra efficiency, because again, we'll be converting something that people may not want to eat, even though they theoretically could eat, into something that's a little bit more palatable, like meat. So what the study did was they looked at chickens, and they fed those chickens either soy protein, which is a typical chicken feed, or soldier fly larva, or spirulina, right? Spirulina is algae, basically. And then they compared the resulting meat from those chickens, both in terms of look and flavor. What they found was that there was no discernible difference between the soy-fed chickens and the insect larva meal-fed chickens. No difference. They did, however, find that the algae-fed chickens had a quote-unquote more intensive color and flavor. But they didn't say if that was in a good way or a bad way. But algae is a kind of a separate issue. You know, it can be a land-efficient way of producing a lot of biological material. Might be better for biofuel eventually than for feed. But, it can be also put into the feed equation. But we have to, like the study suggests, it could actually alter the flavor of the meat. But we'll have to see how that turns out. Importantly, neither group had any negative effects on the quality and safety of the meat. So it's basically a safe alternative for animal finishing feed. So that's it. You know, that is something that we may see more of in the future, not only for human food, but also feeding the animals that we consume and hopefully making the entire system more efficient, more sustainable, optimize land use, optimize water use, and just as efficiently as possible, recycle all of those materials into human food with the least amount of waste possible. I mean, that's what we're trying to get to. And the most important thing that we could do for the environment, I think above all, is optimize land use. You know, reduce the amount of land that we have to convert from wilderness, from ecosystems, into food production land, you know, for people. And insects are incredibly land efficient. They're incredibly land efficient. So the more insect protein that we can feed into the system, whether directly or indirectly, the better. All right, Bob, tell us about nuclear thermal propulsion.
Gladly. DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects, is now planning to have a nuclear thermal propulsion, NTP, system capable of a demonstration flight by 2025. And of course, my inner 15-year-old is jumping up and down in excitement while his older and more mature doppelganger is shouting about time.
Doppelganger, so I love it.
Finally, there seems to be some real hope that we may get a real nuclear-powered rocket in space in the very near future. So we've discussed my impatience for these rockets many times, but as a quick primer, there's many flavors of potential nuclear rockets at a very high level. They're simple. A fission reactor generates heat from uranium fuel, and it heats liquid hydrogen or some other propellant that escapes the rocket, providing the thrust. That's kind of like the bottom line of how this works. The differences between this nuclear energy and the chemical energy, though, has to do with energy density. A nuclear reaction typically releases 7 orders of magnitude, or 10 million times the energy of a chemical reaction. So when it's all said and done, when you factor in inefficiencies and all of that, nuclear thermal propulsion is twice as efficient as chemical rockets. The exhaust velocity is twice as fast. Another way to say it is that the specific impulse, if you want to get this a little bit more technical, which is the amount of thrust you can get from a specific amount of propellant. So a chemical rocket that combusts liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, it has a specific impulse of 450 seconds. Nuclear-powered rockets, the initial ones that we are thinking of creating here is 900 seconds. So essentially, bottom line, trips will be cut in half, which is huge, because when you think about going to Mars and thinking that, okay, we're going to spend 6 to 9 months in this ship with chemical rocket, or just 3 months to 4 months, or say 100 days in a nuclear thermal rocket, that is a huge, huge difference. You don't need gravity assists. You don't have to wait 2 years for an optical launch window. And the radiation, which is a huge thing we've talked about on the show many times, less exposure to galactic cosmic rays and solar radiation, is immense. It's hard to say how important that is, because right now we're not going anywhere near Mars, not only because we don't have a rocket, but because we don't have a way to deal with that radiation, short of, you know, launching, spending many, many hundreds of millions of dollars launching, heavy protective material. So the less time and space you spend, the better. If you look at the history of nuclear thermal propulsion, it's been recognized for a really long time, for many, many decades, that this just blows away chemical rockets. Think about Wernher von Braun, NASA's rocket guru. He knew in the 60s that nuclear was the way to go here. And NASA's been interested for many years, but they've never actually created a flyable rocket. The closest they came was with NERVA, which stood for Nuclear Engine for Rocket Vehicle Application. So that was a program with the Atomic Energy Commission, lasted for 20 years. They made tremendous progress, but it was finally defunded in 1973 for blah, blah reasons, blah, blah, stupid reasons. So nowadays, NASA seems more focused on nuclear energy as a power source, you know, their whole kilowatt system, like for off-world settlements, and that's great. But, you know, you got to get to the planets first. And the more efficient way you can get there, the better. So DARPA's program, let's talk about that. So this is a demonstration rocket for Agile Cislunar Operations, or DRACO. They love this dragon-themed stuff. You may have heard of it in an earlier iteration known as ROAR, R-O-A-R. That stood for Reactor on a Rocket. They want the demonstration ready by 2025. And cislunar, that's a word you're going to be hearing a lot in the next 10 years. Cislunar basically means between the Earth and the Moon. So their demonstration that will be ready in 5 years is going to be called a high-assay, low-enriched uranium, HALEU, H-A-L-E-U, nuclear thermal propulsion. So this is really interesting, because if you look at uranium-235, which is the main fissile isotope that produces the chain reaction energy that we're interested in here, there's basically been two different types of this uranium-235. One was low-enriched, which is typically 3-5%. And that you'll see that in current commercial reactors. Then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got highly enriched uranium. That's greater than 20% uranium-235. Naval reactors have this, and for them, it's typically over 90%. Really potent stuff. But in the middle ground, we now have this HALEU, which is 5-20% uranium-235. And you'll see that in advanced reactors that will be coming online at some point in the future, and these nuclear thermal rockets. And the reason why this middle ground is so key is for these reasons. It allows for smaller designs, longer life cores, less waste, and increased fuel efficiency. Those are the hallmarks of what you need for anything that you're going to be putting into space. That just like hits all the buttons. Those are perfect. So for phase one, DARPA has asked industry for the designs of two different things, a nuclear thermal reactor and a spacecraft to demonstrate it on. And that phase is going to last for about 18 months. The next phases will do with the other obvious things like coming up with detailed designs and then fabrication, ground tests, and then ultimately the in-space demonstration, which is going to be huge. Can't wait for that day if it happens in my lifetime. If you want to look at the benefits now, we got short-term and long-term, which is kind of obvious, I guess. But for the short-term, the main thing that DARPA is looking to do here is to move large satellites quickly around cislunar space. So, for example, if you have a multi-ton satellite, it could take you up as much as a half a year to move it using conventional solar electric propulsion, right? Electric propulsion is really common because you've got solar radiation that you can collect all day. I mean, a half a year with nuclear thermal propulsion, you could do that in a few hours. Now, imagine this, though. We got cislunar space, which is the space between Earth and the Moon. But so if you go out to 22,000 miles, that's where geostationary orbit is. A lot of our communication satellites are up there, right? It maintains a fixed position in the sky from the perspective of the Earth. Beyond that, though, from 22,000 miles all the way to the Moon, a quarter million miles away, it's essentially empty. There's really nothing going on there right now. And so this is where nuclear rocket satellites and other vehicles will be operating in the future. And other countries are making or will make obvious moves to dominate that space. And that's a critical reason why DARPA wants DRACO. It's to have some level of control over cislunar space that other countries are going to be fighting over in the very near future. So now the long term, though, this is where it gets really interesting, because you couldn't use this demo rocket that they're coming up with to go to Mars because you need more thrust. But DARPA is basically doing all the homework here, aren't they? NASA or some private companies could then take that their proof of concept and benefit human and robotic exploration beyond the moon to the Mars and the outer solar system where all the Belters are going to live. So that this is going to be the foundation for future travel within the solar system, I believe.
Bob, do you know, are they going to launch this rocket orbitally? Is it going to be orbital, suborbital? What's the test rocket?
I haven't read any details of the specific exactly what they're going to do, but this will be a rocket that they can demonstrate. So they will have to launch it into space with a conventional chemical rocket and then show off what the nuclear thermal propulsion can do, probably in cislunar space somewhere, probably. I mean, I don't see why they couldn't use a lower orbit, but they could potentially go beyond geostationary. I'm not sure. Another question you need to be asking at this point is like, all right, why now? You know, why? How come now? Why is it special now? Why? You know, this could have happened, you know, potentially years ago. They went really far with it in the 60s and 70s. What, you know, why is it special now? And the key here might be converging technologies. Jonathan Sertain thinks it could happen now, because the enabling technologies have reached a very critical point in their maturity. Like basically now is the time where it's all coming together. Now this guy, who's Jonathan Sertain, his company makes most of the nuclear reactors found in U.S. Navy submarines and aircraft carriers. So, all right, that sounds like a really good guy to be, if not working directly on this, but at least talking about it. So he's working with NASA to design those reactors to power Mars and moon settlements. If not necessarily working on these nuclear thermal propulsion, I'm not sure what his involvement might be in there. So what are these advances that nuclear thermal propulsion can really take advantage now in the 2020s? One of them is refractory metals. These are critical. When you've got an engine that's maybe say 6 feet in length, and it's going to have to withstand an amazing jump in temperature, say going from 19 Kelvin to 2500 Kelvin very, very quickly, you need a special type of refractory metal that's incredibly resistant to heating. And these refractory metals have made huge advances in the past 10 to 20 years. The other one that's even much more obvious is computational power, right? What we have on our desks now were basically supercomputers decades ago. And what this allows them to do is go through designs in days, what would normally could have taken in the 60s and 70s years. So they can iterate their designs much more quickly and come up with, you know, the more efficient, the least expensive, whatever, in much less time than they could have even, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. So these are all kind of converging and coming together. So that's the story. So let's see, you know, 2025 is not far away. They've asked for more money in this past year. They've gotten the money that they've asked for. And so things are moving. And so let's see, maybe this is the time we really start getting rockets that can really do some work in much less time than chemical rockets. I mean, chemical rockets are awesome. They've got us to where we are today. But, you know, it's their time. It's not up. They're going to be around for many decades. But let's see the arrival of nuclear thermal rockets and what they can do. And then from there, so let's get to maybe potentially even more advanced nuclear thermal propulsion. Instead of 900 seconds of specific impulse, they could potentially go beyond 2,000. And you know, potentially get to Mars, you know, imagine in 50 days or whatever, who knows what the potential is, but let's start the process of moving away from chemical rockets and see what nuclear thermal can do and other types of nuclear rockets as well. Eventually antimatter rockets. I said it.
Bob, that's really cool. But, you know, I have to say, I'm a little disappointed. It's only twice as powerful as a chemical rocket. You would think going down from, you know, 10 million times, it would be a little bit more than that.
I know. When I remember researching that years ago and saying, wait, nuclear energy densities are millions of times greater and we're only getting double the efficiency. But remember, that's for the very first generation of nuclear rockets. But we're never going to get, you know, we're not going to get rockets that are millions of times better than chemical. It's just not the transition and the inefficiencies that are introduced by the mechanisms are just never going to get there. So yeah, it's a dramatic difference, but it's a good place to start. But, you know, being twice as efficient is a great place to start, and let's see how far we can go.
And have you read like what the theoretical limit of this approach is of nuclear thermal rockets? Where could we get to?
Well, some of the estimates I read went up to for this type of nuclear thermal propulsion was, they said, 2 to 5 times. So that's where I got my specific impulse of say 2,200. Which is, you know, pretty, pretty decent increase over the 450 seconds of specific impulse for chemical. But that's just, you know, there's so many different types of advanced rocket engines, Steve, beyond nuclear thermal. I mean, how about the engines that essentially explode a nuke near the ship that actually pushes the ship? That type of stuff has been tested, you know, in small scale, and that does work, but it's something that's vastly different than nuclear thermal. There's so many different types of so many weird designs that are beyond chemical that who knows where we're going to go, you know, where the theoretical end is, and that's a topic for a completely different discussion, which I'll be happy to do at some point.
All right, Jay, you know what time it is.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. I mean, that's some serious power or something going on there. So a listener named Rob B. wrote in and said, "Hi, Jay. This week's noisy sounds like a float plane taking off from a river or lake. As a Canadian, I have spent a lot of time out at the lake and have seen many planes land and take off from the water. So we hear the frogs or insects first, followed by the plane starting up and taking off." Rob, cool guess. I'm pretty sure that planes that take off in the water have to have very powerful engines, but this one is not correct. That is not the right answer. Another listener wrote in, Dan Carlson. Dan wrote in, "Hey Jay, a giant engine and or cutting machine of some kind comes to mind with this week's noisy. Trying to think outside the box, this probably isn't right, but any chance the noisy was a helicopter flying with a giant chainsaw to trim back tree branches?"
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. So he sent me a video. I checked it out. And it's really scary. This is like a helicopter flying around, you know, like 30 feet of cutting blades to cut down like tree limbs for power lines. Ugh. And yeah, you don't want to be in the way of this thing with the drunk, you know, pilot flying around, right? That's also not correct. Another listener named Gerald M. Fosk said, "This is a cicada. The windup is the giveaway." Mm. That's not correct, but interesting. I had to look up that sound just to see what it's like. Yeah, there's a little bit of that in there, but that is not correct. I have one more guess I wanted to talk about. This was a close one. He said, "This is my first time guessing, but I'd say that's a turboprop spinning up. You guys stay safe and say hi to Uncle Bob for me." Uncle Bob.
Aw, everyone loves Uncle Bob.
That was from Sean Floors. And that was not correct, but there was a little bit of you know, truth in there, a little getting closer. The winner for last week is from a listener named JP Morier. And JP said, "My first encounter with the Skeptic's Guide and this week's noisy is, this is the startup of an electric-powered radio control helicopter." And he said, "Easy enough to get if you have heard a few key clues are the initial rising whine of the electric motor followed by the whir of the rotor blades and the underlying whine of the gears in the drivetrain." Now, listen, he's right, but he's not completely right, because this one is actually a very particular kind of electric-powered, radio-controlled helicopter. This is the Mars helicopter called Ingenuity, and this will be mounted to the bottom of NASA's Persevere rover. The sound that you're hearing is a test that took place in this helicopter at the NASA JPL. They actually reproduced the Martian atmosphere to test it. And apparently this thing is going to have a series of flights once it's brought to Mars. So it does look like a very small remote control helicopter. It's very boxy looking. And, you know, it has to, of course, the blades have to spin really fast because of the thickness of the atmosphere on Mars. So it's not a drone. It really is an electric helicopter. I think if you look up the details about it, you know, they're still testing it and everything. I'm super curious about this, because anything that's flying on a planet that isn't Earth is fascinating. I mean, that's going to be a really big deal when that is successful. We'll probably get some amazing footage off of it as well. So anyway, thank you, Rob, for sending that in. That was really cool. I have a new noisy for you guys, but before I play the new noisy, I wanted to play a sound a soundscape that a listener named Caleb, you guys have probably heard Caleb guess many times on Who's That Noisy. He made a cool sound I wanted to play for you guys.
Caleb or Caleb?
Caleb. Whatever. Either one works. Caleb. All right. So check this out. He made this sound. I want you to tell me what it is. He has a very specific thing that he said it's supposed to sound like. What was that?
A race car to me.
Close. It's a pod racer.
What's a pod racer?
From Star Wars.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay. Plenty of time. You're so young, Kara. You have plenty of time to watch all these movies.
I've seen them all. I just don't
remember. You don't remember Darth Vader?
Them like you guys do.
Anyway, so he made that sound. Homemade, custom, and I thought he did a fantastic job, and I thought I would play it for you guys because I loved it so much. I do have a new noisy this week, and it is sent in by a listener named Landon Mashin. And here it is. Oops. So what was that? Tell me specifically what was taking place in that noisy. So if you have any ideas on what that is, or if you have a really cool noisy that you heard or you made or whatever, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Hey, just a quick reminder. We got Nexus coming up starting on that Friday night, July 31st. We are going to have a game show with contestants Bill Nye, Leanne Lord, and Andrea Jones Roy. It's going to be a lot of fun. And then Saturday, August 1st, a full day of digital skepticism with our keynote, Andrian. So check it out. Jake, in the details.
Well, you could just go to nexus.org, NECSS.org. And you can also go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/NECSS.
All right, we're going to try to get through a couple of emails. The first one is a quick follow-up to my milk discussion of last week. We got a great email that was just, the subject line was, I am a milk expert.
Oh, yeah. His, like, email was really thorough. Yeah, it was great. He's like, I know stuff about milk. It's weird, but here you go.
Yeah, we love getting these emails from people who, you know, have deep, specific knowledge of a topic that we touch upon and give us some more details. So very quickly, I spoke about the difference between regular pasteurization and shelf-stable milk. And actually, there's just a little bit more details in there. There's a couple of independent variables, and there's more than those two designations. Let me just go over that really quick. So I looked into this to find more specific references. So regular pasteurized milk, again, 161 degrees Fahrenheit for 15 seconds, and then cooled down to refrigerator temperatures. This it kills the most of the bacteria. And so the milk is stable for 7 to 10 days in the refrigerator. If you ultra pasteurize the milk, then you do it at 280 to 300 degrees Fahrenheit for at least 2 seconds. And that just kills a lot more of the bacteria. If you do that, the milk can last. You still need to refrigerate it, but it can last 30 to 90 days. So it just extends the refrigerated life expectancy of the milk, and that's from the bacteria that's already in the milk. But if you want to get to shelf stable, where you could store it on outside the refrigerator, you need to not only ultra pasteurize the milk using UHT, ultra high temperature pasteurization, you also need to store it in a sterile container and hermetically seal it. So you need to seal it from new bacteria getting into the milk or contaminating it, and then you can keep it on your shelf, you know, for up to 6 months. Of course, once you crack open any of these containers, they get contaminated, and then expectancy at that point, they should be consumed within 7 to 10 days once you open them. But anyway, so that's the that is a slightly more detailed, accurate description of the different types of milk available based upon their shelf life.
Right. And the ones that I'm used to that are shelf stable are like juice box size. So it's great for cooking or for, you know, you, to always just have them as backups in case you run out of milk, because it's like, okay, rip the top, pour it, and then it's done.
But why can't you re-hermetically seal it?
Do you have that machine in your kitchen?
But sure. Why? I don't, but I mean, how bad, how hard could it be?
Yeah, so thanks for the clarification. The second email has to do, I'm not going to read the whole email, but it has to do with a retraction of a paper that we talked about on this show. The paper was about police shooting or police violence. And the reason for the retraction was very interesting. Carrie, you wanted to talk about this.
Right. So we've been talking a lot on the show since the Black Lives Matter protests started to pick up more steam, the newer wave of Black Lives Matter protests after George Floyd. We talked a lot on the show about, you know, where are the data? What do they show? And, you know, what can we say statistically about police violence? And you can go back and listen to those episodes because we're not going to rehash all of that. But what I found is that with a lot of pushback, anytime I would maybe post articles that I would come across that showed new data, I kept seeing the same study cited over and over. And Steve, did you look at the study when you wrote about it on Neurologica?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. So this just was like a very heavily cited study. It was a 2019 in penis called Officer Characteristics and Racial Disparities in Fatal Officer-Involved Shootings. And there's a quote from it, quote, "No evidence of anti-Black or anti-Hispanic disparities across shootings, and white officers are not more likely to shoot minority civilians than non-white officers." People love to cite that study in response to some of the other studies that have been cited and some of the other conversations and arguments about racial bias, systemic racial bias in policing and especially in police violence. The researchers have decided now to retract the study. And you can read about that on Retraction Watch, which I, any chance I get to give props to Retraction Watch, highly recommend, guys. It's a great place to read about all the stuff that you read about once and then it didn't make its way back into your ears, even though it was retracted, sadly. So they do a really great job. It's an important public service. The study's authors said that they requested directly to PNAS. So it's not that PNAS retracted the study. The study's authors reached out and said, "We want our study retracted because we were careless when we just..." And I'm reading this as a full quote. "We were careless when describing the inferences that could be made from our data. This led to misuse of our article to support the position that the probability of being shot by police did not differ between Black and white Americans. To be clear, our work does not speak to this issue and should not be used to support such statements. We accordingly issued a correction to rectify this statement." They further said that their data and statistical analysis, or sorry, their data and statistical approach were valid to estimate the question that they actually tested, which was the race of civilians fatally shot by police. But given the continued misuse of the article, they felt that the right decision was to retract the article rather than publish further corrections, and that they take full responsibility for not being careful enough with the inferences made in their original article. So here's, I think, what this boils down to, and sometimes this is the problem. We often love to think about science as though it is a completely kind of clean endeavor where numbers are pure and a researcher finds pure numbers and those numbers tell a pure story and there's no other way to interpret it except truth.
Yeah, people are fond of saying, you know, let the data speak for itself. And I know what they mean, but it's actually not literally true, because in science, data does not speak for itself. It needs to be interpreted in the context of a hypothesis and what's being tested.
Absolutely. Data are only data in so much as how they are interpreted. And so you've got to think all along the way, interpretation is a big part of science. And obviously, this is more the case when you're talking about a lot of confounding factors, sociology, psychology, data. It's less the case when you're talking about specific gene markers, but even then, it's still the case. So let's have a conversation about that. You're doing hypothesis testing. You're making observations about the world as a scientist, and you're saying, I think I see a pattern. Now I want to test the hypothesis that this pattern exists. Then you go and you do some sort of experiment, and then you analyze that data, and then you interpret it. And this is the most important part of this conversation. So what happens is a lot of times when science writers, other scientists, or people who don't study science read a peer-reviewed article, could be a very solid article, they read the abstract, they read the results, and they read the discussion. Some people will read the whole thing, and that's fine too, but the last thing you read is the discussion. So it goes intro, methods, results, discussion. And so the last taste that you have in your mouth are the study authors' ideas about the implications of the study. What does it actually mean? How can it be interpreted? Luckily, there's usually a part in there, there should always be a part in there, about the limitations of the study and what does the study actually not tell us. But it's very easy. This is the part where you're kind of allowed to play a little bit in science. And sometimes, like these authors said, they feel that they played too much and that led to people misunderstanding what their data actually showed and taking it too far. And I think this is a really important kind of case study of what we mean as skeptics when we talk about the fact that data are only data through the lens by which they are published. And that's why it's so important that multiple scientists attack multiple problems multiple different ways. And when we talk in science about theories like evolution, it's because there's been so much incredible research done from so many different perspectives, and they all converge on similar outcomes. That's solid science. But a single study, you know, it only tells you what it tells you. And you have to be not wary, but understanding that it's interpreted through a lens.
Yeah, Stephen Jay Gould wrote eloquently about this topic over 30 years ago. You know, he said that, you know, data doesn't exist in isolation in science. Scientific data, you know, has to be either for or against some hypothesis. That's what makes it scientific. There's always a context there. But I want to back up a little bit, you know, talk about this retraction. You know, I'm very concerned about it. I'm not sure this is the right move. I understand why they want to do it, but, you know, I would prefer to further try to educate people about it than just say, oh, it's being abused too much. We have to get rid of it. We have to retract it. That's just going to feed the conspiracy theories. Now people are going to say that the data wasn't what they wanted, so now they're trying to censor it or get rid of it. This is going to backfire spectacularly, in my opinion.
Yeah, especially about something that's such a hot button issue. It's kind of like, what is the best thing to do at this point? I don't know if it's to republish, you know, with a new interpretation that's just as conservative. And when I say conservative, I don't mean politically. I mean like scientifically conservative as possible. You know, don't make any wild speculation. Don't go too far. Just say, according to, you know, our best understanding, this is what the data show.
All right, you know, interesting, complicated topic. I'm sure this isn't the last time that we will deal with it. But, you know, as always, I just want to say, you know, we try to be as objective as possible, deal with the facts and the science. You know, we're not trying to interject our political opinions here. Just want to talk about the science and how that informs this discussion. But obviously, it goes deeper than just here are facts. Like, it's like, how do we interpret this in the context of how science operates? Okay, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. No theme this week, just three regular news items. And here we go. Item number one, a new genetic analysis confirms that Polynesians made contact with Native Americans before European contact, despite being separated by thousands of miles of open ocean. Item number two, researchers have built a robot scientist capable of autonomously carrying out chemical experiments and using AI to determine what experiments to run, with 1,000 times the efficiency of human scientists. And item number three, scientists have finally been able to produce commercial-level spider silk by genetically engineering hagfish to produce spider silk slime. Okay, Jay, go first.
All right, Steve. The first one here, a new genetic analysis that confirms that Polynesians made contact with Native Americans before European contact. They were separated by thousands of miles of ocean. Well, that would make some sense. I mean, I'm pretty sure the Polynesians were seafaring before European contact. Okay. All right, move on to the next one. Researchers have built this robot scientist. He's capable of autonomously carrying out chemical experiments using AI to determine what experiments to run. 1,000 times the efficiency of a human scientist. Wow. All right, so I think it would be 1,000 times efficient, probably because of speed and safety and even disposal of the chemical experiments. I wonder if it's doing things on like a super small scale as well. I mean, because it would be able to detect things that the human eye wouldn't be able to see. That's interesting. Autonomously, I mean, I would imagine this thing would have to be, when you say autonomously, Steve, this is that's the key word for me that I'm not sure exactly what you mean. Is it meaning can be run completely without the aid of humans?
Once it is set on its task, it needs no further guidance or input from a human.
Okay, I think that one is science. The next one here, scientists have finally been able to produce commercial level spider silk by genetically engineering a hagfish to produce spider silk slime. Now, didn't The Witcher kill hagfish? I don't remember. I'm going to say that one is science as well. So I'm going to go back to the one that says Native Americans were visited by Polynesians is the fake.
Okay, Kara.
Hagfish are like amazing.
They are.
And their slime is super gross, but I can't understand how it would become like a rope. I mean, is spider silk like a rope? It's fibrous, and hagfish slime is slimish. I don't know if you would dry it or you'd have to do something to the proteins because it's like rank, slimy, disgusting. I'm having a hard time figuring out how that could become silk, but I'm sure material scientists figured out a way. Our dear robot scientist can carry out experiments and use AI to figure out which one. So basically you're saying it like iterates on its own. And 1,000 times the efficiency of human scientists. You mean like because it doesn't have to eat a sandwich and it doesn't have to sleep. So that's cool. I could see that would probably really help. And also it can multitask, which we can't do. So right there, I could see it'd be really quick that you could up the efficiency. And then genetic analysis confirms that Polynesians made contact with Native Americans before European contact, before Columbus. So Polynesians came to either like South Central or North America before Columbus. I don't get the hagfish one, but I think I got to go with Jay. But I feel like they did meet, but maybe before Europeans got to Polynesia, not before they got to America. I don't know. I feel like there's a timing issue in that one, so I'm going to go with Jay.
And Bob.
All right, so start from the bottom. The hagfish, yeah, I don't know. I've seen a hagfish in action. It's truly astounding. They just like spit out such vast quantities of slime.
Wait, stop talking.
Yes.
Can I change mine before you make any comments?
Yeah, that's up to Steve,
not
me.
I'm not going to go with Jay. It's up to Steve. Steve, let me know.
Sure, why not?
I think the more I think about it, I feel like that one has to be science because Columbus, it wasn't that long ago. I think it's the hagfish.
So I've got a problem with the hagfish. It's an amazing mechanism, defense mechanism, because that stuff gets everywhere and it's not easy to get off. To convert that into spider silk, man, I don't know. But the Polynesian one, I can kind of see that. They did amazing things. I'm not sure about the timing, but that sounds more likely than some of these other ones. The robot. Yeah, I mean, I could totally buy that. I mean, I don't know about the only thing that's getting me is 1,000 times the efficiency. I mean, I could see 100 times. I mean, they probably could operate, you know, like 23, 24 hours a day at least. I mean, what do they got to do except charge their battery? So they could work many, many hours a day. You know, they wouldn't be spending time, you know, sexually harassing the women scientists. They would save so much time. But 1,000 times, I'm really having trouble with that one, but I think that I'm going to go with the hagfish and say that I just don't see the slime being converted into the spider silk. I think they probably use some other some other creature. I would think it would be bacteria. Just that's just my gut. But so I'll say that one's fiction too.
Okay, so you all agree with the second one, so we'll start there. Researchers have built a robot scientist capable of autonomously carrying out chemical experiments and using AI to determine what experiments to run with 1,000 times the efficiency of human scientists. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Oh, yeah, 1,000,
you sounded so happy. You're so good at sounding happy.
1,000, Steve, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could have said reportedly or according to the scientists. It was 1,000 times. But here's the skinny on this, though. So researchers did build an autonomous robot that was able to do chemical reaction research. And it was incredibly more efficient than humans. So what they were having it do was optimize a chemical reaction. So it could iterate it very, very quickly and also use its own internal artificially intelligent algorithm to determine how to iterate it. So it was deciding like what the next step would be, what the next experiment would be. And then, of course, it could run around the clock, except, as Bob said, for recharging time. It could operate with continuous efficiency. It could immediately check the results and then it figure out what to do next, iterate it, do the next experiment. And they said it accomplished what would take, and they said it accomplished like the entire process of optimizing this chemical reaction, including discovering new and better catalysts. So it did make it actually a specific discovery in days, when it would have taken the human scientist months just to get one step done, just to get a couple of steps into the whole process. So it was just that optimization process was incredibly more efficient than humans doing it.
Wow. Guys,
weren't we just talking about this?
This is huge.
Like, I feel
guys.
Like we were in Australia or New Zealand, and we were talking about drug development and AI. Yeah,
it's physical. It's physical. It's mobile.
Yeah, it's cool. So it's not just computational. Yeah.
Wait a second. That's huge. Automating some aspects of scientific discovery. That is big. Can you imagine this increased by orders of magnitude? Imagine if they had 100 of these, or imagine institutions that will have many of these robotic researchers.
Oh, I think they will.
Absolutely. To me, that's one of the things that I've been waiting for, to accelerate discovery in this way. And of course, we can't automate all of science, obviously. People will be doing a lot of it for a long time, but we'll be increasingly automating aspects of it and automating discovery. God, that's wonderful.
Yeah, so obviously this isn't going to replace scientists. I mean, that's not what this is about. This is more about using it. And it's not just a tool in a lab either. This is more than that. This is about scientists being able to give a task to the robot to say, okay, do this, accomplish this, optimize this chemical reaction, for example. And that will free the scientists up from doing more tedious work to doing more creative work. So this is going to be an incredible tool in the lab.
That's awesome.
I love it.
All right, let's go on to number one. A new genetic analysis confirms that Polynesians made contact with Native Americans before European contact, despite being separated by thousands of miles of open ocean. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Bob and sort of Kara think this one is science. And this one is
Say it.
Science.
Yes.
Yay!
Damn you all.
Yeah, the Kara. High five.
I had a feeling. It hit me.
We noticed.
It was not sitting right. I felt like there were ants in my pants.
So this is an interesting little story, actually. This is a hypothesis that's been going around for a while, the idea that Polynesians made contact with Native Americans, even pre-European, pre-Columbian contact. The original evidence for this came from sweet potatoes. Sweet potatoes is a staple crop in South America, and that's where they're native, and that's the only place in the world, where native, that where sweet potatoes came from, except for a couple of Polynesian islands. And the question was this evolutionary? Just that the ancestor of the sweet potatoes find their way to these two locations somehow, sweet potato float across the ocean or something, or was this introduced? Did Native Americans somehow find the way to Polynesia or the other way around and take the sweet potato back. Now, to add to this, the Polynesian word for sweet potato sounds suspiciously like the Native American word for sweet potato. And so that led some archaeologists, some anthropologists to speculate, well, maybe that was cultural contamination, that maybe there had to have been contact then. But it was controversial, and you know, it could be just coincidence and superficial similarities, etc. So maybe that wasn't the case, so it wasn't convincing. So scientists tried to do genetic analysis, but starting with fossil evidence, but fossil DNA was not of adequate quality. And so this leads to the current study where scientists decide, all right, we're just going to do big data. We're going to look at hundreds of people, you know, Polynesians and Native South Americans, and then look for markers in their DNA, you know, specific sequences of DNA that are unique to that population. If people share unique DNA markers, then you could say with a very, very high degree of probability that they must be related, right? They didn't spontaneously acquire the same mutations. They are there because they were inherited. And indeed, they found them. So there are, you know, Polynesians that have genetic markers that were definitely inherited from South Americans. So at some point in the past, you know, either South Americans made the way to Polynesian islands or the other way around. And they think probably it was Polynesians because they definitely were more ocean-going, found their way to South America. They must have, you know, when people get together, they exchange genetic material. That's what happens. They did that. They brought back sweet potatoes. They brought back the word for sweet potatoes. They brought back some South American genes. And maybe because they brought back a South American, who knows? And there you go. And that happened, you know, over 1,000 years ago or so. So that is now pretty compelling evidence. And Kara, this kind of gets back to what you were saying. You have multiple independent lines of evidence, different ways of looking at the same question, and that gives us a much higher degree of confidence in the conclusion. All right, so let's go on to number three. Scientists have finally been able to produce commercial-level spider silk by genetically engineering hagfish to produce spider silk slime. Bob and Carrie, you think this one is the fiction, and this one, of course, is the fiction, but maybe not as much as you think. So to back up a little bit, the holy grail of material science relating to spider silk has been the ability to mass produce spider silk. Now, we've been hearing about this for 30 years, like literally since 1990 when the spider silk gene was sequenced. And we've been hearing this promise, oh, all we have to do is scale this up, you know, figure out how to mass produce spider silk, and we'll be able to make, you know, sneakers out of it and bulletproof vests and all kinds of advanced material that's, you know, has a greater specific strength than steel and is very lightweight, et cetera. But 30 years later, we're not wearing clothes and sneakers made of spider silk, and that's because they haven't been able to crack this nut. So the base problem is that, you know, unlike silkworms, right, you can't mass farm spiders, right, because they tend to be territorial and cannibalistic. So you can't have a spider silk farm with a million spiders in it. And spiders don't have that much silk in them, so each spider wouldn't be able to harvest that much spider silk from them. So we need some way to mass produce this. And you may or may not know there's different kinds of spider silk, and the one that we're most interested in is the dragline spider silk. That's the one the spiders use. You know, they shoot up into the air, and that's the one that allows them to ride balloon style on the wind. If we could put that gene into a bacteria, for example, and the bacteria will crank out spider silk. So they've been trying to do that, but they just haven't been able. And again, every few years you'll read a story about some company somewhere who were able to splice the spider silk gene into a bacteria. And I did read that recently. That was the item that sort of inspired this fiction. And they say, yeah, and so in a couple of years when they figure out how to, you know, mass produce this, that these bacteria are going to be cranking out spider silk. But it never seems to happen. And here's the reason why. Spider silk has the properties that it does because the chains are very long. The protein chains are extremely long. And then, of course, it also assembles them in the spinnerets. It can control those long proteins. Now, when you have bacteria making it, they often have to compromise and make the chains shorter in order to get the bacteria to produce them. But then in making them shorter, they lose the good quality of the spider silk. And they haven't been able to figure out how to get some other organism to produce silk with the long chains of spider silk and then keep it in that sort of ropey consistency. They've tried doing it in silkworms. That didn't work. They've tried doing it in bacteria. That didn't work. You guys may also remember a few years ago where they did it with goats so that goats would produce spider silk in their milk. Yeah, so it was spider silk milk, not for drinking, of course, but just to see if that could mass produce, you know, the spider silk. But it turns out that company went bankrupt and the goats were just donated, and that research, you know, it didn't go anywhere. Doesn't mean someone's not going to pick that up again, but so that's just another one of these spider silk stories that just ended up not leading anywhere. So I made up the thing about the hagfish. I just totally made that up. But of course, then I had to search on it to make sure that my fake news item wasn't accidentally true. And, you know, it's pretty close. They are looking at the head to see if they could use hagfish slime as a material itself, not spider silk, but just hagfish slime, because it is very ropey, just like spider silk. It's very strong, very ropey. It's also slimy, but inside that slime, yeah, it's just the ropey material. So that is, they're working on that. I didn't see anywhere that anyone's tried to splice spider silk genes into the hagfish. Maybe someone will think to do that. Who knows? But that isn't a thing at this point in time. So that was the bit that I made up. So who knows? This may be something that we read about for the next 30 years and always going to be just out of reach, you know, with this this promise that, oh, mass-producing spider silk is right around the corner. And they finally cracked it. They finally did it. But then we never hear about it again because it's an inherently difficult problem to solve.
Or maybe we should breed a bunch of Aragog from Potter-sized spiders and just milk them.
Yeah, right. What could possibly go wrong? All right. Well, Evan is not here to do the quote, so I took it over for this week. This one comes from Thomas Paine in The Age of Reason, and he wrote, "I have always strenuously supported the right of every man to his own opinion, however different that opinion might be to mine. He who denies to another the right makes a slave of himself to his present opinion because he precludes himself the right of changing it." Yeah, I really like that idea. That's kind of a core skeptical principle, is that you don't tie yourself to any one belief. You allow yourself the right to evolve, to change your opinion as new ideas, new information, new facts, new interpretations come to light. And so, of course, you should afford that to other people as well. And I prefer to take a sort of educational, nurturing approach to differences rather than trying to deny people or shut down any, you know, discourse. So I think, yeah, very important sentiment by Thomas Paine.
Mm.
Okay, well, thank you all for joining me this week, and we'll see you all on Friday for the live stream.
Yay!
Woo-hoo. Yep, we'll see you guys all then. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.